So then we move to item 17, which is an informational item. So please introduce that item. And we knew that Ms. Gray was in the building, but she's actually physically visible within the dais.
Item 17 is building environmental justice capacity in the Central Coast region. It's an informational item and an update to the board on staff's efforts to increase this capacity and stability in the region. Increasing capacity improves support to disadvantaged communities towards getting dependable, safe drinking water and meeting the human right to water. This item continues our discussion from the February environmental justice meeting we had in Watsonville. During that meeting, staff highlighted some of the challenges disadvantaged communities face, specifically the lack of necessary technical, managerial, and financial resources, or we refer to them as TMF resources, and the capacity to identify, fund, and implement solutions that would address their drinking water and wastewater issues. As noted in the supplemental, the request for proposal associated with this capacity filling effort is discussed. And in addition, we'll also hear during this item from Susana Deonda, the co-director of Community Water Center in the Central Valley. She'll share some lessons learned for her and her organization's environmental justice efforts. And first, I'll introduce Angela Schroeder.
Thanks, John. Good morning, Chairman Wolf, members of the board. My name is Angela Schroeder. I'm a supervising engineering geologist here at the region and also the region's environmental justice coordinator. As John mentioned, item 17 is an informational item for us to discuss our efforts to increase EJ service capacity in the Central Coast region. So for the past several years, our board has been very committed to implementing the human right to water and supporting our regional EJ issues. In our local disadvantaged communities, we've had several projects, domestic well testing, replacement water efforts in Monterey County, et cetera. However, despite our efforts, our region has also struggled to maintain a stable, continuous, long-term EJ capacity element that directly supports our local disadvantaged communities to meet their needs for safe drinking water and also wastewater solutions. So to help resolve these issues and consistent with our human right to water resolution, on June 19th, we released a request for proposals, as John mentioned, to establish a long-term environmental justice service program in the region. And that RFP is included in your supplemental sheet. So the program would be funded by our CCAMP GAP program. The deadline to submit proposals is July 20th. So there's a 30-day window to submit, and we hope to select a grantee shortly thereafter and start project implementation this fall. So with that, I want to introduce Susana Deonda from the Community Water Center. She is here to share lessons learned, as John mentioned, from an effective environmental justice program being implemented in the Central Valley. Susana Deonda is the co-founder and co-executive director of the Community Water Center, a nonprofit environmental justice organization based in the San Joaquin Valley. She's a seasoned community organizer and has received numerous awards and recognitions, including most recently the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award, the Latino Community Foundation Leading Change Award, the White House Champion of Change for Climate Equity, the Mark Dubois Award for Friends of the River, 150 Fearless Women in the World by Newsweek, and also Women on Top by Marie Claire in 2012. Susana's experience includes planning and organizing positions at the Center of Race, Poverty, and the Environment. She also served on the Community Funding Board of the Grassroots Fund through the Rap Rose Foundation for Communities and the Environment. She's a co-founder and member of the Board of Water Education for Latino Leaders as well. She has some past in this area. She earned her Bachelor's of Arts from the University of Santa Barbara while completing a double major in Environmental Studies and Geography. So with that, I will introduce you all.
Good morning, buenos dias. As mentioned, my name is Susana De Alba. I'm the co-director and co-founder of Community Water Center. And I actually had the privilege of working at the Santa Barbara County Water Agency when I was an intern in college here. So it's nice to come back to this area and talk about water. I'd like to tell you all that Community Water Center was established because of a need. We have a big crisis in the Central Valley. As a matter of fact, I think we have a big crisis in the state as it relates to water. So CWC was created because we found there was a problem. People not understanding their water quality. And most importantly, people were not well informed on their water quality and why they had to not drink the water from their tap and have to buy additional drinking water. So the sense of not having good information was a big roadblock in the Central Valley to ensuring that people really understood their drinking water. So with that, Community Water Center decided to spin off a water campaign from Southern Race Party and the Environment and actually fund a nonprofit to solely focus on ensuring that our most disadvantaged communities have access to safe, clean, and affordable drinking water. And thus, the Community Water Center was born 12 years ago. Currently, we have two offices. We're based in Visalia, Tulare County, and we also have an office in Sacramento. We have a staff of 15. And as you all know, Central Valley is pretty big and region-wide. Geographically, it's a really vast region, so it's important to recognize that we needed to have two offices to really strengthen the work that we do in the Valley. Before I actually start my presentation, I have a four-minute video that I'd like to share with the board. There's plenty of studies that show in California if you're low income and a person of color. And if you live in the Central Valley, you're going to be exposed to toxic water. Approximately 1 million Californians don't have access to safe drinking water. It's not okay to have people having to fear drinking tap water because they're going to get sick. And it's not okay to continue to condemn future generations to live in this reality. It's time to devote our energy and resources towards solutions. Showcase all of the leaders so that we can also just help promote. Community Water Center is trying to make sure that water quality protection, funding, decisions are being driven by those most impacted and actually addressing their needs. Our strategy is to do massive outreach and organizing.
I used to have the world running, but back in 2014 we still have a little trouble. There's no water. I just found out those buckets to shower, to drink for my family, and a lot of people in Eastport, you know, facing the same problem. Community Water Center, us is a group that we strength to the Sacramento. The state issued $20 million for the city to turn from water to Eastportville. 10 people don't make a change. 1,000 people make a difference.
The center also provides a array of water testing for about 7 contaminants for private wells.
It starts with making sure that people understand the water quality in their homes, who's responsible for it. In many cases, it even means having folks step up into decision-making wells themselves.
I'm not here, but
10 years ago, I didn't know anything about water. It looked clear, so I would assume it was clean water to drink. We found out that we had contaminants in our water. We thought that if we boiled our water, that would help the nitrates. But then we find out that no, they get concentrated. You get cancer from drinking the water. We gathered the community, and I was one of the ones that said, I'll be a leader from the community.
Going to the meetings and talking to our representatives. I didn't want people to translate for me. I wanted me to say it myself.
I believe that no matter who you are or where you are, everybody in California should be able to have safe and affordable water.
The Community Water Center has helped us a lot because we were one of the first communities that started getting the help from the county.
we would not be connected to the city of Asia if it was not through them.
One of the major breakthroughs that the Community Water Center has reached has been a different level of communication with the agricultural industry. Nitrate contamination is now made from confined animal facilities and illegal agriculture. They're now in partnership to fund communities that need safe drinking water.
Through our work, we've engaged nearly 5,000 people across 69 different communities in the city of San Joaquin. We helped pass the Human Right to Water Act and helped create a whole office within the State Water Board that's just focused on small, low-income communities. For all the pieces to come together, it's really going to take communities themselves standing up and saying, this is a priority, let's roll up our sleeves and make it happen.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm really here just to share with you kind of the work that we do in Region 5. And that's just kind of a quick video to give you a sense of our communities, what we work with. And we ultimately believe that solutions are going to need to be driven by communities. So our mission at the center is to be a catalyst for community-driven solutions through organizing, advocacy, and education with those that are highly impacted by the problem to ensure they're at the forefront of change. Here's a draft that was just released, I think it was recently, this past year, that the State Water Board released the Human Right to Water Program that kind of exemplifies all the systems currently that don't have potable drinking water, and those are the red stars. It's good to recognize where the problem's at. So while over 300 systems currently are not providing safe drinking water, I'm happy to tell you that the areas where they're highly targeted to not have safe drinking water, a lot of the residents there are highly engaged in A, understanding water quality, 2, understanding that in a community you have to work with local water better, so it takes the entire collective to bring about solutions. So as we think of potable water systems, it's important to recognize that we live in a community, and residents need to understand A, who they're paying water bill to, and the importance of also engaging with the board when they have local meetings. However, I will say that this map doesn't unfortunately recognize the number of private wells that the state currently has also, and many of them are not necessarily meeting potable drinking water standards. So I'd like to kind of just walk through some basic facts. It's really clear that a lot of our hardworking families are having to pay some of the highest water rates for toxic water. What that means is that people are paying a water bill, and then on top of that are having to buy bottled water. So in essence, paying twice for water. I get the privilege of working with some of the most hardworking families who have to make tough trade-offs on having to buy bottled water or other expenses. And this adds up to almost 10% of their household income alone just to have some drinking water. Now, I would say as a water advocate, I think it's really important that they're not drinking tap water if it's not good to drink. But when that's potable to drink, let's make sure that people are drinking it, right? But it's also a huge burden on people's household income. In addition to that, it's really clear arsenic and nitrate disproportionately impacts people of color. There's plenty of studies that show that if you're Latino or you look like me, you live in the valley, you're going to be exposed to some toxic water. And while that's not okay, I think what's exciting about it is that we have to educate and engage residents that are affected by this reality to ensure that they're making lasting solutions and proper decision-making processes. As mentioned in the video, we're a huge supporter of the Human Right to Water. It took 4 years to get this through, and I will tell you, this law is the only one in the country, and it was a great organizing tool. The Human Right to Water was a great organizing tool because residents were recognizing the power that they had to understand that it's just not okay not to have safe drinking water. But most importantly, they understood the importance of engaging in stakeholder processes at the local, regional, and state level. And while we passed the Human Right to Water, that's an actual photo of the coalition. We were celebrating it when it happened. We actually had not yet drunk food, because it's good to celebrate victories. We recognize that when we pass good legislation or when we pass good policy, it's also really important that we're part of the implementation process. So while we passed the Human Right to Water in 2012, we're still incurring violation in the state. Not everyone has this basic necessity met, and that's not okay. So, with that said, I'd like to also highlight our programs at the Centro Community Water Center. You know, we really believe that we have to have, these are three interlocking, actually four interlocking programs that the center employs, one being community power and engaged leadership. And that's instrumental for any type of work you want to do, making sure that A, people affected by the problem are at the forefront, B, that they have the proper information and capacity to actually engage. It's just not like you just come to a meeting and not really understand what's happening. No, you really take the time to build the capacity of residents to understand what the meeting's about, what are we talking about, and how they can recommend solutions, and for them to really feel empowered and be listened to. In addition to that, we also have a program for this that's called Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Solutions, and that program is really targeted to ensuring that we bring proper resources to public water systems, including private wells, for operation and maintenance, and to improve water quality as well. And groundwater is also a program that we work with to ensure that, you know, our groundwater resources are potable to drink. A lot of the communities we work with are only dependent on groundwater, so it's important that we're also making sure that our drinking water from groundwater is safe to drink. And ultimately, all of these four programs are advancing the human right to water. At least that's how we work. I'd like to just quickly highlight one of our most recent victories was we helped facilitate over 750 homes in the community of East Porterville. I don't know if people were really aware, but during the drought, East Porterville was a hot zone. It's a community of only private landowners, and many of them had their well gone dry for 3 years, and some still don't have running water. So we organized a group called East Porterville for Water Justice, and that really was the kickoff to ensuring that the residents were part of the DWRs and State Water Board's planning efforts in this community. A lot of the residents didn't understand why they didn't have any water, B, what were the resources that were available, and C, everyone was talking, state agencies and local agencies were talking about potential solutions, but they were never engaging the residents. And so we helped organize this group, and you know, once you organize a community group and you allow people to be engaged in the processes that affect their lives, change happens. So I'm happy to report that right now we actually managed to connect 750 homes to the nearby potable drinking water system of the city of Porterville, so folks have reliable water. It's amazing. I will say a lot of these efforts take a long time, but for East Porterville water residents, it took 3 years. Now, that said, there's still some private wells in the periphery of the city that do not have running water in their own tanked water for over 3 years. And these types of conditions are just not okay. And it's important to recognize that resources need to be provided adequately and timely for residents as well as we continue to implement the human right to water. The center also has been working with the AMA Coalition, that stands for Asociación de Gente Mina por el Agua, and it's been around for 12 years. The center has been around for 12 years as well. So it's our sister organization. It's a coalition of residents where we have met every month for the last 12 years, and it's made up of residents, all impacted, representing impacted communities throughout Tulare County, Kern County from Arden, and Fresno, and we meet every month strategically to A, cross-pollinate ideas, B, build capacity, and talk about potential efforts to ensure that we mitigate our drinking water. We talk about strategic actions to ensure that programs are truly mitigating contamination from the groundwater sources. And also, it's a space where we have consistency in terms of people meeting each other, and there's a sense of power building because we meet every month and share resources. So AMA has been around for a long time, and it's only growing. And they've been at the forefront of change. With that, I'd like to conclude and just let you know that we really believe that community residents need to be engaged throughout the process to ensure that we have good programs, we have lasting solutions, and ultimately that they're part of the implementation process for their communities as well. I will conclude, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I will look on my left. So I'll start with Mayor Delgado and move this way.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Susanna. Your presentation was brief and powerful, and it kind of demonstrated a little bit to us the tremendous amount of work you and your associates have accomplished. And it's like a life legacy that you've already completed, and you have a lot of life to go. But thank you very much for all that you've done. My question is, from your perspective, what needs to be done to achieve sustainable groundwater?
To achieve sustainable groundwater management?
to achieve groundwater that is sustainably safe to drink, let's say?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think it's a dual strategy for that. A, we have to ensure that we're protecting groundwater sources from further contamination. B, we have to ensure that we have resources to bring proper treatment into our communities. And C, you know, affordability is a big problem. There's a community called Madera in Fresno County that actually applied to receive over $2 million in a running treatment plant to treat arsenic. Well, it's a community of about 300 connections, so the cost of running that treatment facility that cost over $200 million was unaffordable, so currently they're not using it. So we have to recognize that we have to think about resources, how we share resources, how we broaden scale so that we have economies of scale so we can have affordability. A lot of the systems that we're working with are small and very, I mean, they're real, but a lot of them could be connected pipe to pipe, or we can share different types of resources to optimize efficiency. So I think it's going to take a couple of things, protection of groundwater sources from contamination, creating good programs that bring resources to our community so that they can have proper treatment, and then keep in mind affordability.
Just to follow up, you talk rapidly. I didn't understand everything you said, but did you say that there was a $300 million facility built that's underutilized?
Yeah, I do talk fast because I tend to translate for myself, so I can slow down. Yes, so in Lanier, Fresno County, there's an example of a situation where the community has arsenic. And they applied to get a treatment facility. It cost them over $2 million to bring in that facility. And because the connections are small, there are 300 connections, the economies of scale made it unaffordable to continue to use the treatment facility. So as we think of solutions, we have to keep in mind the economies of scale in our community so that we have affordability and water quality.
You're welcome.
Thanks for being here, Susanna. Hopefully you got in last night and safely and didn't have to drive from the Central Valley today. So I just want to recognize all the tremendous work that you've been doing aware of it for a few years now, but I really appreciate you coming and giving us a presentation and letting us know what's happening. So from your perspective, apart from the affordability aspect, what are some of the other challenges you see in terms of capacity building? And then with those challenges, I'm sure you see opportunities here. Very bright and lots of energy, so hopefully you can give us a little bit more insight into what else needs to be done.
Great question. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges that we see, not only just as it relates to water quality and water supply, but the social infrastructure. The people running these boards have to have the right capacity and training to run sustainable, thriving, and healthy water board systems. And that is a big challenge, but it's also a big opportunity for us to ensure that we are intentional in providing the support and the resources that they need. The center, last year we kicked off what we call the Community Water Leaders Network, and it's specifically targeting local board members in office to provide adequate resources, and we meet with them every month. And it's things like, how do you read a budget? What's a CCR report? Maybe we should translate that. Such basic necessities, but that's real because board members are making lasting decisions. So that's a big area of challenge, but it's also an opportunity to build that capacity and leadership.
So with Ottawa, are you building those capacities in the communities and then growing those leaders? Leadership people coming out of that opportunity?
Yeah, okay. Good question. So we have the Ottawa Coalition that I highlighted, which is grassroots residents, mothers, nurses. Some board members are also part of this coalition. In addition to the coalition, the center also kicked off last year what we call the Community Leaders Water Network, and that is a network only targeted for decision makers, so people already in local water boards, with the intention to ensure that we have proper resources and support for them to continue to thrive on the local water board.
Thank you very much.
Hi, and thank you for your presentation. And it's comforting to know that there's good energy working, at least in the Central Valley, on these issues. How involved have you been with the Central Coast region?
How involved?
I do hear the name Ottawa mentioned from time to time, but this is the first time I think I've seen your group come before, so I could be mistaken, but curious about what's going on, any overlap, any work being done?
Yeah. You know, years ago, I actually attended one of the Central Coast Regional Water Board meetings as related to Area Lands Program. So we don't work
we haven't worked in the Central Coast. We've helped our allies, like Environmental Justice for Coalition for Water, and we are also just, I'm originally from Salinas. I grew up in, I was raised in Salinas, California. So I'm familiar from the farm workers' perspective of the reality of the region, and it's very similar to the Central Valley. It's very similar, except the Central Coast doesn't have as big mega dairies as we have in the valley, and we probably have better air quality than the Central Valley. So we haven't been as intensive working with the Central Coast, which is a little bit, but we look forward to continuing to support as well.
So, you know, we've said, we've published a request for proposals. Is your group at all going to be submitting a proposal or working with anyone that you know that's going to be submitting a proposal?
Yes, we're looking forward to submit our proposal by deadline. So we will be submitting ours.
Yeah, we are.
We'll be submitting a proposal.
Perfect. Okay. And so from what you've presented to us, I mean, the problems are not just the contamination, but just water supply. So like in East Porterville, looks like what was going on, was it Visalia?
East Porterville.
Yeah. So that was a decrease in the aquifer table. Correct. Okay. Is that being, that's being handled with the SGMA law, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act?
Well, you know, SGMA is the state law that's going to help us manage our groundwater sources, right? And a lot of the systems, as a matter of fact, a lot of the private wells that went dry in this part of it was because of a drought.
Yeah.
Really, it's because a lot of people started to drill in Tulare County massive deep wells, and the city had, the county had no proper control on permitting new wells. So what happened was when the aquifer dropped, we actually had land subside 200 feet in some locations. And so a lot of these private wells were shallow, so they went dry. So SGMA did have major implications on people's habits of fear, frankly, of losing water sources. So these people started to drill deeper wells, causing major damage to public homeowners and also public water systems that rely on two wells that have groundwater. So you're right. I highlighted water quality, but also supply is a big problem as well, in addition to affordability.
So in that area, is there an agency that's now been designated to handle the SGMA requirements?
Yes. And SGMA, I mean, there's a lot of GSAs that are being developed. So there's over 25 in our Tri County area, and it's a challenge, but I think the goal is to ensure that we have sustainable groundwater management.
And is your group interacting also with the SGMA agencies?
Yes, we are.
Okay. So you mentioned arsenic and nitrate in your presentation. Any other contaminants? You know, you mentioned toxicity, and I just want to know, is there more than nitrate and arsenic that you're...
Yeah, unfortunately there is. There's more things like 1-2-3 TCP that we found on MCL to start regulating. We have arsenic, we have nitrates, we have perchlorate, uranium, bacteria, DBCP. So we have a plethora of contaminants in our drinking water. And what's really important to recognize is that a lot of these primary contaminants don't have a smell or a taste. So you really have to know what's in it. So once again, it's important that local boards are providing CCR reports in an adequate language that people understand to make better choices. And in many cases, if we boil water with nitrates or arsenic, it only increases the concentration. Very serious.
Thank you very much.
So I will start all the way on my right. Ms. Cervantes.
Thank you again for your presentation. I think that I have followed your career and been inspired by a lot of what you've been able to do in the Central Valley. I grew up in Tarabella, right next to Flint to Porterville High, so very familiar with a lot of the issues that are going on there. And I've also had the opportunity to visit your center and also take a tour of the surrounding communities like Goshen, and also other communities, you know, right outside of Visalia. And I think that a lot of your influence we have been able to see here in the Central Coast with the Human Right to Water and thinking about our work here on the Central Coast in relationship to that goal that the state, that very ambitious goal that the state has set out for itself. So I definitely see your influence from the Community Water Center and a lot of the policies that and practices that we're attempting to do here on the Central Coast. I just wanted to ask you, you know, we're very limited. You know, we meet maybe every other month. And I think also local water boards are only meeting, you know, on a monthly basis, if even that. So I want to ask you, you know, what can we do more of to be able to ensure that we're providing and empowering, not disempowering, community for stakeholders that we don't have the opportunity to interact with as frequently as you might be able to since you're on the ground and in the community?
Great question. I'd like to say that I think there's a couple of things we should consider. One is just recognizing that we want more stakeholder involvement. What audience is that? And then ensuring that we have adequate spaces and time and adequate translation devices. I mean, maybe we need a translator, you know? In addition to that, I also think that it's important to partner up with nonprofits. A lot of nonprofits could be a partner in making sure that they're also building the capacity and understanding of residents to engage in decision-making stakeholder processes. So I think it's a combination of things. You recognizing what kind of board you want to be, and then being in tune with the audience. And then secondly, partner with nonprofits to ensure that we bring in that sustainable, consistent understanding of what the regional water boards are mandated to do, how we can work together. And it all comes down to good communication.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you. First of all, Tammy, is there any way to turn that one light off? Everything but... There. Okay. Oh, it's you. Thank you for coming. I have followed the work of the Community Water Center for some years and have been really impressed by it. As somebody whose background myself is as an organizer, I have been really struck by the focus on capacity building, on leadership development, on the kind of very slow work of developing a deep base, rather than simply going for immediate impact, and I think you guys have really grasped that and really implemented it in a very impressive way. In the Central Valley, which is not an easy environment to organize in, small communities in the Central Valley. So, I am curious. I'd like to hear a little more about a couple things. I'd like to hear a little more about your the leadership development program you've been doing with you're meeting monthly with people who have become decision makers. How many people are involved in that, and kind of how many boards do they represent? And I'd just like to hear a little more about that. It intrigues me.
Yeah.
Because I've seen people work real hard to get people elected, and then they're sort of the one person on the board who's not part of the group that's been there for years and isn't supported and doesn't really know what they're doing there. That's a hard situation to put people in.
That's a really good reflection and question. I like to say that, you know, the center really works bottom up. We work towards ensuring that we recommend good policies or programs that are developed from a problem or a gap we see on the ground, and then ultimately you have ownership of people in those programs. So the community leaders network is coming out of a need. We recognize exactly your point. Having one member join the local water board was just not good enough. People really felt disempowered, and then they didn't encourage other people to consider to vote for a local water board. And I agree with them. It's really disempowering when you don't have the proper training and support. And then most importantly, the biggest challenge is that some of the people that are on these boards have been on them for a long time. So humans are creatures of habit. So certain habits are just really hard to change. So with that, we created the Community Leaders Network, and we have 13 members currently, and all of them are local water board members from the city of Evans. He's actually the mayor that's on this one as well. We have some folks that are small systems schools, a school member, a school representative as well is on this board, and many of them are community services district members. And they meet every month with the understanding of
having the space to understand what resources are being provided at the state level, how do we leverage and make them down, and then what are the problems that each of them are facing in their local water boards. And many of them are talking about, you know, vacancies. How do we bring in this new pipeline of people to encourage them to run for these offices that are making some big decisions that affect people's lives?
So they kept coming.
They keep coming, yes.
That means something. The other thing I'd like to hear about is a little bit about how the relationship has gone between you folks and agriculture in the work you've done in the Central Valley. I know having worked to represent farm workers, there's always this kind of conflicted relationship that they're often fighting with their agricultural employers. At the same time, they have a deeply vested interest in their employers succeeding too, because that's the economy that they live in. So I'm really curious, as I know you folks were engaged in a lot of the East San Joaquin stuff, in just kind of hearing a little bit about how you've worked, I guess, with them as a distinct group of stakeholders, somewhat representing different folks than you do.
That's a good question. You know, we work on the foundation that we have to understand that we are part of the fabric of life. So whether we're farmers or farm workers or any other resident of the community, we're part of the fabric of life. So we need to, A, recognize each other and respect each other. And respecting each other is also understanding differences. And it's okay to have different perspectives. But that said, specifically with the agricultural community, given that I do work with a lot of farm worker communities and residents that depend on that for their job, they also recognize the importance of having good water from the tap. I mean, we have to have healthy bodies to be able to grow food and harvest food. So I do think that we've moved in the right direction. It's taken a lot of work, a lot of relationship building, but we really do believe that we need to all be at the table to find solutions that are winnable for everybody. And that's a slow process. It's a process of understanding our differences and really getting to know each other and not fear each other, because I think when you fear, you provide wrong resources and wrong policies. It hasn't been easy. But I think we love challenges and we're up for that. And so I will say that currently, you know, we've been really working on major policy work where the industry has come to the table and they want to be a part of the solution. We've had great press conferences and events where the industry says, you know, we recognize we've been part of the problem and contributing to nitrogen pollution and we want to help solve that. And that's a big shift. That's a huge shift. And so just shifting that and now putting that into action is going to be the next step. So it's taken a long time, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you so much, Ms. Gionda. And again, we're those of us that are familiar with your work and the Community Water Center in particular has made waves or breaking through I think our understanding of how difficult it is and how many different issues there are that need to be addressed. So in your short presentation, you were able to touch on a great range of these issues. We have not had a sustained presence of an organization like yours in the Central Coast for very many years. When I first started on this board 13 years ago, it was a very nascent conversation about what does environmental justice look like relative to water quality. And it's advanced in good part. We've had interest in a technical ability to at least begin to understand what it looks like, where the issue, you know, where the problems are. So the data that we've collected and the way in which we've gone around about creating the possibility for discussion with, for example, county health agencies and others who have some both resources, authority, responsibility, accountability for providing and assuring safe and affordable drinking water, we've advanced that dialogue through establishing and building better
data sets, mm-hmm. and actually being able to point to areas and say, okay, we know that the wells in this area are very likely contaminated, and we followed that up with well testing, drinking water wells that are isolated and have never been tested since they were installed. So these are all, boy, they take time, they take effort. Our staff has been very dedicated. We use settlement funds often to advance these programs. We have a long, narrow, skinny region. And so we find that the problems in the north part of our region are very different than the problems that are occurring in the southern part of our region. So we have worked with different organizations, but again, their staying power is very, very limited. And they're kind of surviving grant to grant. And in between, they lose their staff, and then hopefully more grants come down, and then we're able to see them build up their staff again. But we lose the relationship with the community that comes out of those efforts. And building trust, which is another dimension of how we interact with our residents who are most susceptible and most vulnerable, are reluctant to engage with government agencies. So we have to have these organizational presence that provides not only information and kind of technical understanding and leadership building, but also just trusting that what we're offering by way of well testing, or what we're offering by way of setting up databases so that you can look on a website and see, you know, what kind of water do I have in my region. Those are things that we're able to do, but without that community organizing process going on, we've discovered that is really the key piece. And I know this RFP that we put out has been a great challenge to put it together correctly, put that RFP together correctly with a lot of input, both from community and from the State Water Board. We've had a lot of support as well. And we're fortunate we have some solutions in potentially, you know, underway in our region, and we're hoping that will have potential for statewide to solve these problems where there is no consolidation possibility or there are no infrastructure funds to really open up the ideas for creating new drinking water facilities and systems. And that's the UCLA project, which I'm sure you're aware of, so we're all watching that carefully. But that's, you know, 3 to 5 years out from actually providing on a scale that would actually start to solve problems. So my question, finally getting to a question, but I wanted to put that into the background because I think there's so many ways in which we all are working at these issues. My question for you is, this takes money. And as I said, we've been using settlement funds. We've received small grants directly to our programs. Indirectly, we support State Water Board issuing grants to organizations that can get certain parts of these almost phases of work going. There is bond money. There is Sigma money. There's potentially the new bond money coming down. And I think one of the challenges I still see is defining DACs, how we're constrained by the median household income as being the major or the main way of identifying where this money should be directed. And then the lack of social, as you said, social organization, social infrastructure to administer, even if they can meet the criteria for identifying what the problem is, the ability to administer a grant, actually implement it and maintain it and sustain whatever funds may be available to start to improve infrastructure. All of these issues require that we reconsider what we call a DAC, disadvantaged community,
I'd also like to know if you think there's a better term. I know there's concerns and sensitivities about being labeled a disadvantaged community when the problem is not of their making. So I don't know. I've asked you a number of questions, and I'm sure you have thoughts that you can share with us.
Yeah, I think, thank you for your framing. Some feedback to that. I think that, A, you know, the reason the Center has been really successful in Region 5 is because we recognize that organizing at the core needs to be happening at a fundamental process, because you build relationships with residents and you have short-term, long-term strategies that build momentum towards a bigger goal. And understanding that everything's connected to each other. That's one. The other thing is, you know, when it comes to funding, as a nonprofit, it's a continual habit. We're always fundraising. And we also are so devoted into this issue, we're very targeted to the issue, that we're also leveraging a lot of support, funding-wise, towards this issue. And that's another one of why we've been really successful. We're really focused. That said, you know, we also do a lot of work to ensure that, you know, bond funding or any type of resources is trickling down to the community water system level. And that's a different thing from a nonprofit. For them, it's similar, though. They also have to have the right leadership capacity and of understanding where the resources are at, how you leverage them, and then what's the technical application process you have to go through. And a lot of those pieces, you know, a lot of these systems need that. And so what happens is they're working with a number of nonprofits to coordinate that kind of support. So it is possible, but I do think that in some areas we can optimize those resources and streamline that a little bit better. Now, that said, you mentioned a really, really important theme is urgency. I mean, a lot of our communities, whether they're called disadvantaged communities because of a technical term to receive some sort of, you know, a resource, we can have that conversation probably offline. But I will say the reality is we have a problem, and so we need to continue to focus on the solution, and the solutions need to be designed adequately for our communities. So a false belief that everything solutions are universal, that's not true.
Yeah.
Every community is different, and they can be a mile or two apart and still different. And we have private wells, we have community services districts, we have mutuals, so every community is different. Now, that said, the conditions and the problems are very similar. They're very systemic. Our water quality is poor, infrastructure is old and dilapidated, affordability is a problem, and then the social infrastructure of those folks that are running these systems are not always well trained and equipped to manage those systems.
So I know that the leadership training and education that you do you think that those are more universal in terms of how those programs are structured and the way that you create engagement and bring people in who, as in your video, mother who said, I decided I could be the leader.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I could take this on. So that takes training and that takes support. And so do you see your program being able to relocate its kind of the template or the formula for that to other communities where your lessons learned about doing this efficiently and effectively for people, they're working, they have families, it takes time. So how do you see that?
Yes. Well, you know, it's all about practicality. And so we create a lot of resources and documents and educational material that's really geared towards residents so that they understand all the way from the health contaminants, what it is, where it comes from, what could you do about it, bottled water, certified filtration devices. So we have a lot of literature that I totally think can be applicable in different regions. We just need to adapt them. So that is one. In terms of the approach, I do think it's also replicable to ensure to figure out what is the type of infrastructure that we can create in different regions based on that need. And I will say, I do think that networks that support leadership is critical. And if you don't have that, it's a missing gap to ensure that people feel empowered and have the adequate space to ask questions for clarity that sometimes they feel to ask in the local board meeting. So that's important. And in addition to, it's also important to recognize that we can create coalitions where we just have ordinary residents coming together, having access to good information, and then figuring out how to best make decisions for their families.
One last question, and I hope it's a quick one for me. Is the health community involved, your health professionals in community clinics, do you see them coming into the picture? Because
that's one aspect that I have been looking at for a long time, and what I find in talking to medical professionals, they're not aware of the profile of a person who's suffering from chronic exposure to contaminated water. And they're treating different diseases, illnesses, but they're not making the connection to the fact this person's been drinking nitrate or arsenic for 20 years or more.
Yes, I would say that the health community is joining us in different spaces. The Nurses Association is definitely aligned and working with us on statewide policies. But at the very local level, we have to tell you that we actually worked on a project to install proper filtration devices in local clinics that had arsenic. So the actual clinic had arsenic, and so we had to install these filtration devices. And it just tells you the lack of understanding of that constituents and that audience, too, that we need to educate our doctors and nurses to ask the right questions. Well, where do you live? Are you drinking your tap water? Well, maybe you're getting sick because of that. So there's a lot of education to do with that audience as well. So thank you for asking.
Yeah, thank you.
So thank you. And I have three specific questions. Firstly, just a comment, heard a lot of good things about your organization, so it's nice to finally meet you face to face. First question is that I believe it was last year, there was a bill passed that requires the opportunity to consolidate drinking water supply facilities because of the issues where you have sometime a small community on private wells with contaminated water, and yet you do have not very far a water district or a city with potable drinking water, and they're like, no, you're outside of the city limit, so too bad. I have personally seen the example in the Central Valley on one of the field trips where I could actually see from the distance a fire hydrant from a city, but no interest to hook up. With this new bill that was passed, it does provide regulatory support to promote that. So have you leveraged that yet in the Central Valley?
Part of the culture that we have in the Central Valley, I can only speak for that region, is this idea that we know best, locals know best. And while you're right, this consolidation, this forced consolidation, now has become a regulatory support. For some, it's a threat, right? And for others, it's a solution. Now, that said, we supported another organization that was actually working with a community called Metheny Track, who was the first to actually mandate consolidation to the city of Tulare. And it wasn't easy, and it wasn't... So you have to recognize that people perceive power in different ways. And whether they have a smaller board with not functioning well, it's still their board, and they still have some sort of power there. So when you force consolidation, it's not easy. And it's also the bigger systems don't always want to take in the lower systems. They don't want to bring in what they call the low-income area. And so you have this big friction. Now, that said, I will say that in some areas, it's just not viable to have water boards that are not functioning. We have some areas where they can never meet because we don't have a quorum. And so I think in certain situations, and it's a case-by-case, where you want to consider that strategy. Has the center done that? No. Are we going to consider it? Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Second question. Back to Sigma. I think my colleague, Mr. Young, asked a couple of questions on Sigma. One of the components in Sigma in the formation of GSA and the governance of GSA, it does require to engage communities through community meetings that have representation of disadvantaged communities, tribal, environmental, etc. So have you seen that an easy path to get a little bit more daylight exposure? Or you had to sort of use gentle persuasion to become a voice?
It's a combination of efforts. The GSA formations, it's critical that the formation includes DSA representatives, tribal representatives, and at a core understanding of community drinking water systems.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to recognize that in the Valley, groundwater has been regulated, and we depend on that for a lot of things. It's also for growing food. And so these formations have not been easy to even have discussions around drinking water sources. So it's a case-by-case situation. Now, that said, the center has helped a number of them to include DEC representatives on the government structure. So there is some middle of grounds, but then it goes back to the leadership component. While we're part of these GSA's government formations, it's important that we also continue to support the member on those GSA's because it's not easy to be on them representing public water systems.
Yeah, of course. All right, so then my third question. Back to a comment that you made earlier about your efforts working with the industry. So could you give, it's a two-part question, could you give an example of industry relations success that you had? And then the second part of a question, do you have any suggestions on how perhaps more enhanced partnering with the industry, could help? I'm thinking about the portability of your experience in the Central Valley to here, the Central Coast.
That's a very good question. So our experience with working with the industry in the Central Region, Region 5, has been a challenge from the beginning. Just even recognizing that we can talk about nitrates now without feeling threatened. So just even in spaces, stakeholder processes, where we're engaging with the industry, the shift in just discussion has shifted from more of listening to each other. Not necessarily always agreeing with each other, but more specifically, we've been working on huge pieces of legislation this last 2 years where the industry has recognized that they want to be part of the solution as it relates to nitrate contamination. And that is big. And so we've actually had press conferences where we've all be on the same side, and it's just pretty amazing where the growers, the dairy industry has come together, and we're standing together saying, we have a problem. Nitrate contamination is very real, and we also want to help solve that. And it's important to recognize that we want to solve it not just on the interim with a band-aid providing bottled water, is thinking about short-term wins. How do we get a solution right now? But then what's the long-term strategy to reform the way we grow food, to prevent further contamination into our groundwater? That's one. And I think the broader answer I would say is that the relationships, the way we work is, we want to make sure that people affected by the problem are at the table. And it's important that the industry also allows us to have that space. And now when they do, it's great. And when they don't, we're still there and having these discussions. I think that we have a long way to go still to recognize that the industry requires bodies to grow and harvest our foods that are healthy. A lot of our farm workers, are having to pay a lot of bill that their own, the industry pollutes or contributes to pollution. And those discussions at the beginning were really hard to have. A lot of people feel that they will lose their job. But I think that we organize around hope and change and solutions. And part of that is understanding who's part of the problem so we can get to our solutions.
So, has there been any specific action that you can trace to these relationships that you have built?
Yeah, so specifically on the pieces of legislation that we're working on right now, the industry is putting forward $140 million into this, what we call the Safe and Sustainable Drinking Water Fund, that would allow systems that have nitrate contamination to tap into that source. We haven't been successful thus yet, but the idea that they're putting funding money into a fund so that communities can leverage is pretty powerful. That's a long, I never thought we'd get there, and we're here now.
All right, thank you. So I have four speaker cards, and what I suggest to my fellow board members is we hear comments from these additional comment cards. And then I would like to hear, as part of a staff summary, giving our board
the process that you're going to be using associated with the selection in VRFQ for the next step here. I know we received supplemental information, but I think it would be good to get a summary. How are you going to approach this? How are you going to review the grants? What's the selection process, etc. Thank you in advance. So thank you very much, and we may bring you back in a little bit. So I will start with Abby Taylor Silva, 3 minutes, and then Claire Weidman, and then Kay Mercer, and then then Lawrence Hinkle afterward.
Good morning. Abby Taylor Silva with Grower Shipper Association based in Salinas. So I just wanted to start with saying how much I appreciate Susanna. We were in a meeting together with the Water Solutions Network about a month ago, and I just really appreciate her way. I think that she brings a lot of into collaboration. And the Water Solutions Network, just so you know, she's an advisory board member on it. It's a group of 24 different people throughout the state. So it's people from Trouts Unlimited, it's people from health departments, it's the Nature Conservancy, and then I'm in it as well, as is Paul Robbins with RRCD. And we're all getting together. It's being sponsored by private funders, but CORO and WELI, which is the Water Education for Latina Leaders. It's bringing all of these people together to talk about water on a statewide scale. And what's been really neat for me about it is I'm actually kind of learning about drinking water issues from a totally different perspective, from the health departments and from just infrastructure issues and arsenic, and it's really neat to kind of look bigger picture. But part of the reason I say I like kind of the way Susanna presents is I feel like it's similar to our experience with the Nature Conservancy on the Salinas River, because I think that the perception maybe sometimes when I get up here and speak is that it's agriculture versus the environmental justice community and versus the environment. And I think sometimes based on the people in the room, it might seem like that, but that's not actually our culture and style at Grower Shipper. Our culture and style is very collaborative. And I think you saw that with the Salinas River Project. And I think you also saw it with the stewardship group and all the work that they've done and all the water that they've provided. And I think that some of our experiences, not to beat a dead horse, but when I was on the CCGC board, we invited people in to talk about what we were doing from the environmental justice community who came to one meeting and then said, we don't want to talk to you anymore. And I think that these broader discussions with people who see the value of agriculture and see the value of working together. Susanna's group has worked with Western Growers, who you know is our partner on this drinking water bill, and they've moved mountains in my view. So I wanted to echo some of that collaboration and that's really being talked about on a statewide scale as well. And just remind you too of the good work that's being done by the stewardship group. I know you've seen in your board reports, 561 individuals have been identified who've accepted drinking water, and that's in addition to all the drinking water being provided on irrigated lands. That's in addition. So, I enjoy conversations like these in which we're talking about collaboration because I'd like for our board to be seeing that more with us and different groups. And final thing to say, 7 seconds, and we talked about Sigma. It's always important to note in the Salinas Valley on our board, there's an environmental seat and there's a disadvantaged community small water system seat. That is very unique. And that, what Susanna's saying about industry leading it, we led that. We wanted to see those seats. We wanted that diversity on that Sigma board so that we could make good solution-oriented decisions. Thank you.
Nice input. Thank you. Ms. Weidman?
Hi, good morning. My name is Claire Weidman. I'm the president of the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. I just wanted to mention a few things really briefly. Yesterday I was in a meeting with folks from the US EPA, and they mentioned the WIFIA loans, which I hadn't heard of before, but it's related to water infrastructure, and the letters of interest for those are due coming up on July 31st. So I don't know if there's maybe interest or opportunity for that. I also wanted to mention, and Dr. Wolf, you alluded to this, some of the other policies. We were working with our partners at the Environmental Defense Center on LAFCO policies and looking at policies. And one of the issues that came up is this issue of extension of service. And that's something for, because of the drinking water issues, because of some of the need and desire to potentially construct housing in the county jurisdiction, that's something that's really important. And you heard in the discussion yesterday about environmental health and the LAMP. Those are all things that definitely overlap and go into being able to address these situations. And ERLAMP is another great vehicle for understanding and moving forward for these. But I think that overlap is really important, being able to look at all of these different pieces together to be able to look at these different projects and policies together to help advance meaningful improvements. And I think it's really important to build the capacity to navigate those. It's certainly a difficult process, or it can be, but it can't be insurmountable. And if it is, then we need to change whatever that stumbling block is to be able to address those policies and concerns. So with that, just want to emphasize the need. And as you know, many hands make for light work, so we'd appreciate the partnership and being able to identify and implement some of these projects and policies to make improvements. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Dr. Hunter has a question.
Just could you repeat the information you provided on your USCPA meeting and the, I think you mentioned, program or funding?
Yes. So I was actually surprised to learn how much of their budget and programs does have to do with grants and loans. That was new to me. And it's WIFIA. It's WIFIA loans. And it's
I have an email I can just send you. It's WIFIA funding, and they did. There's a letter of opportunity, and so the EPA extended their opportunity to July 31st, and so it's just a simple letter that needs to be submitted for water systems, and so I'm happy to send that information out.
Thank you.
Next is Ms. Mercer. Okay. And then last will be Lawrence Henkel.
Thank you, Chair Wolf and board members. My name is Lawrence Hinkle. I work for Mission Ranches, and they're a grower in the Salinas Valley. And listening to Ms. Deanda's presentation, I have to agree with her on the lack of leadership at some of these local water boards. I know that with our nearby community that's disadvantaged that we're working with, that it's really hard to get a quorum together. So I also know that we've committed large amounts of money to the Salinas Basin Stewardship Group, and I think they're doing really good work. I think they found a place where they can really help ag provide for these communities as well. And then lastly, I think my concern is that we might be adding additional layers of complexity to some of the issues that are currently progressing towards resolution that we're working on, and maybe some future issues by adding some of these environmental groups in. I think that if they're going to work towards finding people within these communities, I know we've tried to encourage the community that we're working with as well to bring people in so that they have at least a quorum most of the time that they meet. I think it's a good thing, but to rile up something where we're already, stir up something where we're already to have the community's best interests at heart, I think it might add added layer of complexity to some of these issues. So, thank you.
Thank you, and appreciate you carved out the time on your Friday to drive here. So thank you very much for that, sir. So at this time, I'd like to Mr. Robertson, to have staff maybe take us to the next step.
Yeah, so I'll start off, and then maybe Ms. Schroeder can add on if I haven't covered it all. So just looking at the timeline forward with respect to the request for a proposal that is currently out on the street to fill the environmental justice vacuum that we see and that we've talked about over a couple of meetings so far this year. On July 20th, the proposals are due. We anticipate it'll be about 2 weeks to evaluate the proposals, make a recommendation, and move forward. The tentative projected start date is September 1st for the grant itself. So we're talking basically 2 months from now. I'm remiss. I should have said thank you to Susanna. Appreciate her good conversations that we've had, she and Laurel Firestone, over the last few months, and the education that she's brought to us. I also want to acknowledge Community Water Center's success in a very challenging political climate. It's a testament to the values that Susanna mentioned in her comments to us. I think that's it. Angela, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I can share a little more about our review process. I think that's what you're asking about.
Yeah, I think, you know, myself and pretty sure my fellow board members are interested to see what's going to be your selection process that you're going to use. Is that something you're going to do internally? Do you have some staff that you have assigned for this? You know, this is a significant opportunity, and we're talking about a significant amount of money.
Right.
So I think it warrants a little more explanation. We've had some other, you know, grants that we provided of a much smaller scale than, you know, like a recent one with
right.
Ms. Kennedy. So I think this warrants a little more. A deeper explanation.
Okay. So this one is about 10 times the value of,
exactly.
of the previous grants. The Las Lomas grant for bottled water, for example, was, I think, about $26,000. The grant you mentioned with Ms. Kennedy was $25,000. The primary reviewers here, I think, are Matthew Keeling to my right and Angela Schroeder right behind me.
That's correct, and we also have we'll get input from Mary Hamilton. There's also some EJ issues related to surface water, and also Katie McNeil, who is our grants coordinator. In addition, we've also involved state board staff. So, Gita Kapahi staff from the Office of Public Participation will be involved in our review. So, the RFP itself contains some very specific language about minimum requirements, both for what we expect the proposal to include, as well as with the statement of qualifications, in terms of the qualifications of the organization, or a group of organizations could submit together. It also describes our selection process, both in terms of some key areas that we're going to be focusing on in terms of the proposal and the qualifications. For example, the demonstrated ability to have sort of a continuous, long-term, effective, both funding as well as internal capacity, the ability to staff process projects in the long-term, demonstrated success in community organizing and relationship building, as well as demonstrated success to partner with all stakeholders. So we don't expect an organization to cut, sort of swoop in and resolve the EJ issues, but we expect to see some long-term leadership and to partner with all stakeholders, our existing EJ organizations that we know, you know, how small projects we implemented, as well as our water quality partners who are trying to address water quality issues in our environmental justice communities. So again, as John mentioned, the proposals are due July 20th. We expect to review them over approximately a 2-week period with those staff and state board. Our group will get together and make a recommendation to John, and then we'll update you on our selection at the December board meeting.
So, see, question from Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, given the timeline where submittals are due the 20th, and you're going to make a decision 11 days later, and the concept is for the project to start, I believe, at the start of September. And given the size of the grant making we're talking about here, I'm wondering if it doesn't make sense to have maybe a subcommittee of the board participating in that discussion and selection process. Because it is this is an important thing. And you know, for the decision to be made, and then we'll hear about it in December. Three and a half months after the work starts, doesn't feel quite. I just feel like we could contribute something, and it's better process. So that's my input. I'd be happy to participate in that if that's because I'm a very
commenting
interested project.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any input from my colleagues?
I support the idea that Michael just suggested, but I had other comments when it's my turn.
Okay. Let's address this, and then you can, you know, bring other comments. And any thoughts?
I'm fine with the concept.
So then if we're going to have input from board members, a subcommittee, three or less, okay. So I think it would be good to have, you know, a second board member.
I would like to see three board members. I would volunteer. I've been working with staff on EJ issues for quite some time, and with Mr. Johnson's familiarity with the northern region air issues, and Ms. Gray's involvement in Irwin and her assistance to the Kennedy contract, I think she could bring some insights as well in what we're hoping to see in the scope of work that comes forward.
Yeah, so I'm actually, I was thinking about, you know, who's going to be our team, I thought. I do appreciate your suggestion, and so that will be your subcommittee with Ms. Grace, Dr. Hunter, Mr. Johnson, and then I'll let staff work with you, you know, maybe a conference call to, you know, to address this. And just a quick question as I reflected on the deadlines. Anything, you know, these are pretty tight deadlines. Is there a specific reason why we kind of crunching this so tight, you know, from the submittal to the selection 11 days later?
So I'll say this. You'll note, first of all, in the supplemental, the request for proposal is included in the supplemental sheet
right. That
was submitted to you.
Right.
And it presents the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
The good former consultant in me always leaves an option there. You'll notice the word tentative in that. In the selection date and subsequent start date, acknowledging the schedule issues, etc. And we can work with that, you know, acknowledging we'll have another layer of discussion with the subcommittee.
Okay.
We can relax the schedule.
Want to make sure we got a good, healthy process and we're not trying to, you know, cram it through because of
So, we'll get together, staff will get together, and then we'll reach out to the subcommittee and set up some communication points.
All right. I think we got a plan. So thank you, the three of you, for volunteering for this. And
Well, I'm happy. I mean, I work in the Central Coast region with disadvantaged communities, so I got it.
And I think there's also, you know, geographic benefit here because we have, you know, Ms. Gray is in the Santa Barbara
area. We have you in the northern part. We have Dr. Hunter in the central part. So we have also good geographic representation of Region 3. So I think that works perfectly. So thank you. Now, Mayor Delgado, you had an additional question or comment.
Yeah. I'm looking for some clarification from staff. After reviewing the scope of work behind the RFP, the request for proposals, the scope of work itself seems enormous. It includes things like coordinating with partners to successfully implement short and long-term drinking water and wastewater projects, assist the disadvantaged communities to increase localized technical management and financial capacity to effectively implement wastewater solutions and drinking water solutions. This is the holy grail for this topic, and it was a gut punch for me recently when the San Gerardo Cooperative was unsuccessful, even though they had such determined leadership and partnership and outreach from Horacio and Mesquita. So my question after that is, what kind of projects on the ground, what kind of initiatives on the ground does staff expect this request for proposal to achieve that San Horacio couldn't achieve? I'm sorry, San Gerardo could not achieve.
So I'll start, and then maybe Angela can add. But I think looking at development of leadership at the water agency level, you know, the micro water agency level, offering tools to help them manage and develop their own technical, managerial, and financial means. Helping them to become aware of funding opportunities, technical assistance, become aware of affordable technical assistance. Those are some examples of expectations I would see the grant recipient filling that may not have existed for San Gerardo as they tried to retain ownership, you know, or assume ownership of their own water system. So I think those are some of the aspects that might have been missing in that experience that we would hope wouldn't continue to be missing for disadvantaged communities in the region.
So does staff believe that the scope of work is doable?
Yeah, I think so. I'll let Angela and Matt, who crafted the scope, speak to that too.
I'd say that we're very optimistic. We think there are very successful models. I think Susanna demonstrated one of them that's effective in the Valley. I think we're really relying on organizations to come forward with their best proposals and to tell us what they plan to do and, you know, help to close this gap on the Central Coast. I think in the case of San Gerardo, for example, I think earlier intervention could have changed the path of that. I think we went such a long period of time, with a lack of resources and also, you know, frankly, with a lack of partnerships. So San Gerardo, for example, could have been partnering with Monterey County from the onset in terms of trying to address those issues before their capacity actually decreased over time. So we can absolutely improve, Mr. Delgado. I think that there's a lot of opportunities. I think we have a lot of lessons learned from the Valley. And, this project will have checks and balances, and we'll continue to report out to the board in terms of our progress.
So I also want to highlight, Angela made a fairly innocuous statement about the concept of partnering, too. So this doesn't necessarily have to be an individual environmental justice entity. It could actually be a bunch of skill sets brought to bear through a coalition of environmental justice groups, too.
Right. So, I think our intention is leveraging, right? And so we really hope that we'll leverage the existing resources and even bring resources from outside our region to provide assistance.
And if I, to kind of follow up a little bit on Mayor Delgado, and I would like to draw in our guest executive director in this part of a conversation is that a year and a half ago, you know, we had some of the state board members who visited, you know, various sites, and we had had deep discussion about Sonargo, which in fact, you know, we met with them, and here through grants provided by the water board, through grants, they built a facility with a tank, a drinking water system, etc. And to the long and the short is that what ended up is that this facility is being sold for profit to a private entity who's then going to run this facility and going to have to deal with perhaps rate hikes. And then I look at it, frankly, from, you know, being a California taxpayer, I think it's highly inappropriate to take a project, several million, to build, and then you have a local government monetize it and say, well, you know, you're out. It just doesn't feel right. And it was a very frustrating process we went through. You know, we thought, well, how do we do this? Do we go to the local county and try to shame everyone to reason? That didn't quite work. Then we had the Office of Finance, you know, who said financial, said, well, no, they don't have the funding to operate the facility. And that gets into the other issue of drinking water systems is that, you know, it's one thing to get a grant, but, you know, you got to operate it too. So I just wanted to share with you this example because that was one where, you know, a lot of effort took place. We actually, you know, did tap the shoulder of your colleague board members in Sacramento, and, you know, the hands were tied. Then I looked at the legality of taking a project which was state-funded and then turn around a few years later and monetize it. And, you know, we were not able to find a little sliver somewhere in the laws that says, you know, you can't do that. You know, I just want to tie back to your example there because I think that was one that sticks in my mind as being, you know, not a good story. And I know you shared yourself your frustration to that, and you too, Mike.
Yeah, I think that I'm glad you raised San Gerardo and the many, many challenges that the community helped to define for us. You know, it seemed like the getting the well replaced and kind of internally with organic leadership that they had and their own self-will of determining that they were going to identify the solution to their problem, which they did in successfully getting a new well. But then what played out after that, we all have learned so much from that. And I believe State Water Board would staff that have engaged with us in these various phases of effort to maintain the water system for this community, that we have all, that's informed a great deal of what's going forward now in terms of the language and in terms of criteria, in terms of the way the funding has become more and more targeted to meeting the needs of disadvantaged communities. So in the end, I think, and yesterday my comment about San Gerardo, in the end, what we want two things. Safe drinking water, so they have that. Now what we're going to fight for is affordability. And I think if we end up with those two conditions in place, then San Gerardo will have been a success story. Now, they had a path, they envisioned a path of continuing to maintain and operate that water system it was a challenge. And their ability to continue to do that was relying on a small group within the community of San Juan. So in the end, it may be that the State Water Board's evaluation turned up some very important points about the long-term sustainability of operating that system. So, okay, let a water purveyor come in and with conditions that recognize this was taxpayer money, this was a public system that was designed to meet the needs of one community. What we don't want to see is that water being reallocated to surrounding community. The water shortage in the Monterey County area is notorious and will continue to be a huge challenge. So there's some things that we can still watch for and make sure that we support the community's interest in securing and sustaining their water supply and in making sure that their water rates do not increase from what they are now, not considering what the water rates need to be given a water district's need to, I mean, there should be some kind of tiered rate structure possible. I mean, that's Public Utilities Commission, blah, blah, blah. But there's some things still to go, but I think San Gerardo should and hopefully will end up in the right place.
So my plug-in may be one of the legislators' wish list is when grants are provided, there needs to be some language that assures that it doesn't become a money-making for a third party, because that was part of it too. Was, well, you know, if we sell it, and there were willing parties saying, we'll buy it from you. We need to have some strings attached. So, thank you for allowing me to get this off my chest. I feel so much better now. So, do we have any further comment on this item before we move either to the next one or we take a short break? What's your pleasure?
Let's take a break.
Okay, let's take a short break, 15 minutes. Reconvene at 5 to 11.